What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of Eyewitness History. Today, I speak with Raymond Benson. Raymond Benson is the author of over 40 published books, including his latest novel, The Madman Murders of Marigold Way. Raymond is perhaps most well-known for being the third and first American author to be commissioned by the James Bond literary copyright holders to take over writing the 007 novels between 1996 and 2002. In total, he penned six original Bond novels, three movie novelizations, and three short stories, all published worldwide. His book, The James Bond Bedside Companion, first published in 1984, was nominated for an Edgar Allan Poe Award by Mystery Writers of America for Best Biographical Critical Work. Two anthologies of his Bond novels, The Union Trilogy and Choice of Weapons, are currently available. We discuss a lot in this interview. We certainly discuss how he came to be a writer for the James Bond novels, what his thoughts are on the craft of writing, period, and what he's doing now, among much more. And now I give you Raymond Benson. Okay, I'm here with Raymond Benson. Raymond, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. I'm excited to speak with you. I'd love to just jump right into it. I'd love to ask you, when did you first consider doing James Bond as an author?
Well, I was asked to do it. Nobody can just say, hey, I want to write James Bond books, because they're owned by Ian Fleming's estate. You know, they control it. So they periodically hire authors to do the continuation books. You know, Ian Fleming himself died in 1964. So his estate, you know, a few years later decided, you know, to keep the character in copyright and so forth, they would periodically hire new authors. The first one was Kingsley Amis, who wrote one book in 1968 under the pseudonym Robert Markham. That was called Colonel Sun. And then they waited a while. I mean, they did some other sort of side projects. The next author that to do, you know, adult new original novels was John Gardner. And he was hired in 1980, and his first book was 1981. And he was in the seat for a long time, about 15 years. And he did a lot of books. And then I was next. But there is a story of how they found me. So.
Is that the
would that be the next question?
You allowed me the smooth transition. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. Well, one of the more unusual things about this was that I'm American. You know, I was the first American to write these books. There have now been two, but at the time I was the first one. I grew up in, you know, I was born in the 50s. I grew up in the 60s. I was there when the original Bond movies, you know, came out on the big screen. I saw all the originals on the big screen. The first one I saw was Goldfinger, and my father had taken me to see it when I was nine. And it, of course, just completely blew me away, because you know, you have to remember that in the 1960s, the Bond movies were the Star Wars of that decade. They were the big block. They were the only big blockbuster movies. There wasn't anything like that. There was no real franchise like that. I mean, there were imitations that came out after the success of Bond, like, you know, the Flint movies or the, you know, Matt Helm movies and things like that. And television got all did imitations like The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and The Avengers and I Spy and all that. But that was all because of Bond. The books had been, you know, been published all through the 50s and were still being published. And once the movie started, there was a big push with the publisher to get all of these books out in paperback everywhere. And in the early 60s, Ian Fleming's books were everywhere you went. They were just, you know, in every little kiosk and dime store and airports and, you know, bookstores. They were huge, huge, big sellers. So I saw Goldfinger, and then within 6 months, they released a double bill of Dr. No and From Russia with Love, the first two movies. So within 6 or 7 months, I saw the first three movies on the big screen at the age of nine, a very impressionable age. And I started reading the books, and you know, they were adult books, but I was a good reader, and I could grasp the stories. Maybe a lot of the stuff went over my head, but at the time. But, you know, I reread the books a little later when I was older and reread them again and reread them again. And so, you know, I grew up to be basically a huge, you know, Ian Fleming fan and James Bond fan. But I became a normal person. I went to college. I studied theater, actually. Got a degree in drama. I moved to New York City. I directed plays off Broadway. I composed music. I'm a pianist. I was composing music for theater. I was doing all this artistic stuff and had no desire. I mean, it wasn't in my wheelhouse that I was going to be a writer. I wanted to be a stage director and a music composer. And I did that for many years. But in the 80s, 1980s, I've told this story a lot in many interviews, but there were some friends of mine and I, we were sitting around a table and the question came up, what book would you write if you had to write a book? And my turn, when it came to me, I said, well, I'd like to do a coffee table, you know, encyclopedic work on the history of James Bond, because, you know, there were only a couple of books on the movies at that time. There were a couple of biographies of Ian Fleming. There were maybe one or two books about the novels. A lot of these were out of print. And I wanted something that had everything in the book, you know, the movies, the books, Ian Fleming's biography, the history of how it all happened. All of this in a big giant tome, because I wanted to own that book, you know, and I thought, you know, that'd be fun to write. And they all, my friends all said, well, gee, you should do that because you know a lot about James Bond. And I started thinking about it and kind of obsessing about it. And I talked to a friend of mine who had published a book. I said, how'd you go about doing that? You know, he introduced me to his editor at his publisher. And he said, you know, my friend here has a pretty good idea. You should listen to him. So I pitched the idea to this editor and she said, well, I think you need to write a proposal for a nonfiction book. You know, I had no clue how to go about this. And she told me what you have to do for a proposal. So I went home, I wrote this proposal, gave it to her, and I got a contract to write the book overnight.
Wow.
Yeah. And the book, you know, writing the book took 3 years. I did go to England. In the process of the research, I met members of Ian Fleming's family and the people who run his literary business. And that was key. And then when the book came out, they liked it. We stayed in touch all through the rest of the 80s. This was while John Gardner was writing the books. And we kept in touch. I did, you know, little odd jobs for them. And I had no, you know, it wasn't even in my dreams that I would even be writing Bond novels. During this time, I got involved in computer games. After this, my book, it was called The James Bond Bedside Companion. It was published in 1984. I had gained a literary agent. And this agent, almost about like a month later after the book was published, said, hey, you like games, right? You know, board games and computer games. And at that time, PCs were just coming into the home, you know, like the Apple IIc and the Commodore and things like that. And primitive early games were these text adventures like Zork. And these were, they tell a story as you play the game. The kind of, like, for example, it'll say, you are in a forest and there is a sword on the ground and there's a path to the east and a path to the south. What do? You type, pick up the sword. You now have a sword. What do? Go east. And it reveals this story as you go along and solve puzzles and talk to characters and things like that. But it's all text. There's no graphics. So I was hired. My agent got me a job with this game company that was doing these kind of text adventures. So I started writing fiction in the form of games.
Interesting.
Yeah. And they were very complicated plots, too, because you had to have paths. If you go off and do the wrong things, you know, you still had to have something happen. And that set me on a path for about 10 years. I was doing computer games and I moved around the country. I got hired by other companies. And within those 10 years, you know, computer games got more and more complex and graphics came about and they became more like making movies. And so in the early 90s, I was, you know, doing big worldwide games And, you know, the scripts were like giant, you know, 500-page documents. So that's how I honed writing fiction, you know, because there's characters, there's dialogue, there's obstacles and plots, real complicated plots. So in the meantime, I guess the Ian Fleming people, there was a man who was in charge of it. His name was Peter Jansen Smith. Peter was Ian Fleming's literary agent back in the 50s and 60s. And he was now in charge of the literary business. And he called me out of the blue in 1995, late 1995. And he said, Raymond, John Gardner has decided he wants to step down and not write any more books. And we wanted to know if you'd like to give it a shot.
Wow.
Just surreal.
I know it was. It was totally surreal. So I had written a novel during this computer game period, a first novel, a mystery novel. Wasn't very good, but I had shown it to Peter. I had said, would you read my novel and tell me what you think? And he did read it, and he gave me some good comments. But, you know, what he saw, I guess, was that I could start a novel and I could finish a novel. And that's very important. Finishing a novel is very important. A lot of people start novels and never finish. So he knew I could do that, and he knew I was honing my fiction even better. And more importantly, I think, he knew that I knew the Bond universe inside and out. So he was willing to give me a shot, you know, to see what I could do. It was kind of an audition. I had to come up with an outline, a plot for a first book, and he had to approve it. You know, the Fleming estate had to approve it. The British publisher had to approve it, and the American publisher had to approve it.
Wow.
Yeah, so I was being edited three ways. Once the plot outline was approved, I had to write four chapters on spec, and same approval process. And then once that was all done, I got the contract to write the book. And I did the first one, and then they added more to the contract. So I did it for 7 years and did six original novels and three movie novelizations.
Wow, that's incredible, Raymond. Thank you for running through that. That's an amazing story. I'm kind of curious if there was any sort of struggle in terms of finding your voice as a writer for the James Bond novel, because obviously you're dealing with, across the whole corpus, a bunch of different authors. Was there some sort of, let's call it, structure that the publishing company wanted to maintain across all books? Does that question make sense?
Not really. Mm. I mean, when I first started, there was a conversation. We had a conversation about what direction we should go in. Now, John Gardner had been setting Bond in contemporary times, that is the 80s and early 90s. We had a conversation, you know, like, well, gee, should we just continue that? Or should we, like, set the stories back in the 50s or the 60s, you know? But when GoldenEye, you know, the movie GoldenEye, the Pierce Brosnan movie, that came out around the same time that I got the call. And it was, you know, a huge hit. It kind of revitalized the movie franchise. And so it was decided by the powers that be that, you know, the book should just remain contemporary, kind of be in sync with the current movies. And in fact, you know, I basically got two directives. The first was try to make my books a little more like the movies, you know, with a little more humor, a lot more action, the same kind of contemporary plots. And secondly, make M, the character M, mm-hmm. The boss, sure. Make her a woman. Just like the movies had just done with Judi Dench. So I think their idea was to, you know, try to find a new younger audience, you know, with my books that were into the movies, you know. But there is quite a difference between Ian Fleming's books and the movies. For one thing, the Bond character, he's very humorless. He's very cold. He's a killer. He broods a lot. There's a lot of self-reflection going on in the Fleming books, and I wanted to keep that. And he had of course, had a lot of vices as well, the smoking, the drinking, the womanizing, and I wanted to keep all that. I said, I want my Bond to be Fleming's Bond, despite being in these sort of contemporary settings. And they said, well, if you can pull that off, do it, because mm-hmm. we'd like that too. So it does make him a little anachronistic in the 90s, you know, but it's just like that line that Judi Dench tells Pierce Brosnan, you're a misogynistic dinosaur. Well, yeah, Bond is, you know, so yeah. I managed to do that. And so that's what we did. So I kept the spirit, you know, they didn't want me to try to write like Ian Fleming. That's impossible because he was writing in the 50s and the 60s. His, you know, thrillers were not being written that way anymore. They wanted me to write contemporary thrillers, but they wanted me to keep the spirit of Fleming in there.
Gotcha. I understand that. That makes sense to me. I'd love to discuss a little bit about process, Raymond, then I'd like to track through some of your books, if I may. You told David Zaretsky from The Bond Experience that the hardest part of writing a Bond novel is the villain and the plot. Mm-hmm. So what is your process like for ideating a plot for a novel?
Okay. Well, you know, we in the thriller and mystery business call writers either plotters or pantsers. You know,
yes.
They write by the seat of their pants. And plotters are, you know, plan, do a preparation before writing the book. I'm a plotter. And, you know, it was the Ian Fleming people. I mean, Peter wanted an outline for that first book before I could even get the plot, the contract. So that kind of trained me in how important outlines were. Now, I totally admire these writers that can do it, that can just sit down and write by the seat of their pants. You know, Stephen King does that, and mm-hmm. Lee Child did that. And they're great writers. I couldn't do that. I want to plan out everything I do. I want to know how it's going to end, you know. My outlines, it's not really an outline. It's a prose treatment broken out in block paragraphs. And each paragraph represents a chapter. What happens in that chapter, plot-wise? What moves the story ahead? So I don't get into, you know, dialogue or character much. It's just, you know, what's going to happen in each chapter that's going to propel
story structure.
Yeah, exactly. So before I even start that, I have, for the Bonds anyway, I had to figure out what my story was. I would kind of look at a map of the world and pinpoint hot spots that Britain was concerned about. So for example, the first book, if it was going to get published, I knew it would come out in 1997. And what big event in history was going to happen in 1997 that concerned England, and that was the handover of Hong Kong. So I thought, well, that might be an interesting situation for Bond. And so I did a little preliminary research on the history of Hong Kong. Why did Britain own it in the first place? And why were they giving it back? And I learned all about, you know, the opium wars of the 1800s and how Britain got the territory. And, you know, somebody in London, when the treaty was drawn up, wrote into it, we'll give it back to you in 100 years. That's how it was. It was that simple. And they were going to honor that. So I could imagine that after 100 years of British rule, there was going to be some people upset that it was being handed over to a communist country. And I bet a lot of British people living there would be upset. They'd probably leave, you know, or businesses, you know, British businessmen who were ensconced in Hong Kong. Their whole businesses would change. So that's kind of sparked, okay, who's going to be the villain? Well, it's got to be a British businessman. So that's where it all kind of happened. So then I start writing the outline. And while I'm doing the outline, I'm also looking at locations around, you know, the Hong Kong area and in Macau and even southern China where things could happen. So it all kind of goes hand in hand, the research and the outline. And I really spend a lot of time on the outline. I spend 1 or 2 months on an outline, and it's only like 16 to 20 pages, single spaced. But I really work out all the twists and turns and the red herrings and the what's going to happen. So then once I'm done with the outline and it gets approved, then I actually go to the locations. I actually traveled to all my Bond locations and walked in Bond's footsteps, took notes, took pictures, and amassed this amount of research. Got home and then start to write. And when you've got that outline, it's like a blueprint. It's like a map. And it really saves you time in the writing. I can just, you know, get up that morning and look at the outline and go, okay, what's happening today? Oh, yeah, it's this scene. And I could just write it, you know? Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't mean I'm married to the outline. If something occurs to me while I'm writing and I want to change something, I can. I mean, you know, it's okay. So I try to write a scene a day, as long as it has a beginning and an end. It might be a whole chapter. It might be just part of a chapter, might be 2 pages, might be 20 pages. But if I can get that scene done every day, then I think I've accomplished my work for the day. And if it's a short scene, then hey, I can go see a movie in the afternoon or something else. But like Ian Fleming did, I like to get through the first draft without looking back. I just want to plow through that first draft, and that establishes a pace, an urgency. And I don't look really start going back and revising until I finish the first draft. And then, you know, there's revising, there's adding, there's deleting. I may go through it, you know, 2 or 3 times. Then I have some beta readers that kind of look at it and read it and give me honest criticism. And once that's done and I'm satisfied with it, then I turn it into the powers that be. And then there may be another revision or two. So that's basically how it works. And I still follow that same routine with my own books, with my non-bond books. I, you know, come up with the premise, do an outline, do traveling if I have to, research, and then write the book.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Oh, thank you, Raymond. That's awesome. I appreciate you running through that. The process is something that always kind of fascinates me. It's always amazing to me to hear other perspectives. I'm a writer myself. I write for just a variety of outlets, and I've gone by plotting and I've gone by pantsing, and I've found benefits in both of them. That there's, in a way, there's freedom in trusting your gut and your instinct. But also when you're working on deadline and you do have to keep to a, you know, an A plus B equals C sort of formula, as many editors tend to like, then having sort of a framework that you can key off of so you know in your head how it's going to go, there's value in that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whenever I've tried to do pantsing, I always kind of write myself into a corner and then realize, oh, no, I've gone wrong somewhere. And then you have to back up. You got to throw some stuff out. And I find it easier to do that with the outline rather than, you know, it's easier to throw out a block paragraph or two and start over on the, you know, back up on the outline than it is to throw out, you know, 50 pages that you've spent some time on writing.
Yeah.
And you're going, you know, oh.
I'd love to discuss character development for a minute, if I may, Raymond. So like you just mentioned, you know, the character had to be a British businessman. And of course, you're imbuing that character with, you know, a variety of qualities, you know, good and bad, you know, so on and so forth. I'd love for you to talk about the creative process as it pertains to developing characters and the challenge of creating, let's stick with antagonists, you know, in the series.
Right. Well, I mean, for Bond, there is a formula that you know, all the Bond villains are, you know, there has to be a financial incentive involved, like with everything they do. And they're megalomaniacs, they're narcissists. So they all have those qualities in common. You just have to figure out, you know, skew it to whatever the story and location is, you know. And it helps me in developing a character to cast it in my head with an actor. I don't necessarily, you know, reveal in my writing who that actor might be. But in my head, I want to hear his voice. I want to hear him. I want to picture that actor and that voice as I'm writing. And instinctually, the character comes out. It just happens. That's the only way I can explain it. Interestingly, though, I never had an actor in mind for my Bond.
Oh, that is interesting.
Because when I read the Fleming books, I did not picture Sean Connery. I pictured this sort of shadowy, kind of noirish, shadowy guy. And that's the guy I always see when I read any new Bond books or anything. And so that's who I saw when I was writing. So, you know, when readers would come up to me and they say, oh, I could just picture Pierce Brosnan saying these lines, or I could picture Sean Connery saying these lines. If the reader could picture their own Bond reading my books, then I guess I succeeded, you know. That was very gratifying. But for the villains and the women, all the other characters, I would cast it, you know, as if I was casting a movie.
Is there a, I just feel compelled to ask, is there a particular character you're thinking of as I ask the question? I'd love to know which actor you cast.
Oh, well, in the first Bond novel, 0-10, that British businessman, it was Jeremy Irons.
Good one. Awesome. Thank you, Raymond. I appreciate it. And yeah, so I would love to track through a couple of your books. You allow me, once again, a smooth transition. 0-10. You already hinted at it, more than hinted at it, but I'd love to just ask you directly, how did you approach creating this new adventure for James Bond in this novel, besides obviously what you just tracked through?
Well, you know, I really wanted to do a Fleming-like plot. I had the, you know, I wanted this exotic location, Hong Kong, Macau, China. And once I decided that it would be about the handover, it had to be about the British businessman, you know, trying to disrupt the handover. You know, of course, he's a little deranged, too. So he's trying to start a war between China and Britain. So I just, you know, that's where the seat of the pants comes from. And that's when, once you have that going, then you kind of make it up as you go along as you're doing the outline. So I'm a plotter, but I'm a pantser as I do the plot. I mean, I would think that's how anybody does it, you know? And I knew, you know, there's got to be some action scenes. There's got to be some sex scenes. There's got to be, you know, the food and drink scenes. There might be a gaming scene because, you know, there in several of the Bond stories, there are games, you know, like there's a bridge game in Moonraker. There's a golf game in Goldfinger, et cetera. There's a Baccarat game here and there, you know, Casino Royale and other books. So I thought, well, what would be unique? You know, how about Mahjong? You know, not only in America, but in Hong Kong, it's a big deal. I mean, people gamble on playing Mahjong, and there are different rules too in Hong Kong than there are in America. So I enlisted the help of a Chinese family that played the Hong Kong version of Mahjong. And for a weekend, I intensely played Mahjong so I could write about it. So it's little things like that. You know, I wanted, you know, we think that the bad guy is triad leader. The triads were, you know, pretty big then. And I was also influenced, I think, by Hong Kong cinema in the 90s. The John Woo movies like, you know, The Killer and Hard Boiled and Better Tomorrow and things like that. And also the Jackie Chan movies. So when I was in Hong Kong, I'd made arrangements with the Royal Hong Kong Police to talk about the triads, and they were very helpful. They presented me with a transcript of a triad initiation ceremony, and I used it in the book. I got permission to use it in the book. So, you know, as I was doing the research, I would learn about stuff that I would go, oh, I've got to put this in the book. So I would find a room to make a scene out of it. And that's basically what happened.
You know. Wow. I'd love to know, Raymond, what was it like when that first book of yours, first James Bond book, finally got published? You know, you've been a fan of James Bond your whole life, right? And now you're officially part of the James Bond corpus. Where were you? What was that feeling like for you?
Well, I was here in Illinois. It was a surreal, like you used the word before, a surreal experience. I mean, when my first book was published in 1984, that was just, I couldn't believe it. I'd written a book and it was published. I was 29 when that book came out. And here I was now, how old was I? I was 41 when 0-10 came out. So yeah, I was stunned. And, you know, there was a lot of book signings, parties and celebrations. And, but then, you know, I had to keep going. I had to write more. You know, for 7 years, I kind of rode this roller coaster. I traveled the world and met a lot of cool people, and it was very intense part of my life.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Raymond. I'd love to move on to, if my research is correct, by all means, correct me if it's not, your 2000 book, Double Shot. So twin assassins, I think, are a really unique, intriguing threat in the book. What was it that inspired those characters, and how did you develop their dynamic in the prose?
All right, Double Shot. I don't want to give away any spoilers, but there is a double of Bond in it, okay? Now, that trope has been used a lot. In The Man from U.N.C.L.E., there was a Napoleon Solo double. There have been doubles and other, thrillers and mysteries and, things like that. And I thought, should I tackle that? And if I did, how could I make it different? And also, Ian Fleming had written a novel in which the entire plot was the bad guys want to kill Bond. That's it. That's the plot. And that was From Russia with Love. John Gardner had one where the bad guys just want to kill Bond. That was called Nobody Lives Forever. And I thought, well, gee, let me do one. I want to do one, see if I can, So the whole plot of Double Shot is the bad guys want to kill Bond, and they use a double in the plot. So that's how that pretty much all came about. But then there's also the geopolitical plot, that has to do with Gibraltar and Spain and Britain and, conflict over that. So that all ties into it as well. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, it does. That's perfect, Raymond. Thank you. Earlier you told me that you, when the situation allows for it, you prefer to travel to sort of doing your pre-research for the book. I'm curious if you have any cool research stories for how you developed Double Shot.
Oh, for Double Shot? Let's see. Well, I did travel to Spain and Morocco and Gibraltar, all three places. All the places in the book I visited. One of the cool places is the hotel in Ronda, where the character Margarita Piel does a parachute jump off, because it's up way up on a cliff or on a bridge, and to escape, she jumps off of that. So being there was really cool. Being in all those bull rings, and I did have to learn a little bit about what it was like to be a matador and what the whole philosophy that the Spaniards follow with bullfighting. I mean, it's a controversial thing here in America, but in Spain, it's like a religion almost. It's very well respected. So I wanted to dive into that, kind of become an Ernest Hemingway, kind of have that kind of philosophy behind it. So I befriended a couple of famous matadors there, and one of them had us out to his ranch where he actually practices fighting bulls, but the bulls he uses for practice are ones that are going to die. Like, there's something wrong with them. They're physically or mentally, handicapped in some way. So those are his practice bulls. So he demonstrated, he killed a bull in my honor. As my wife and I watched, and then, wow. I went out and, well, that was really great. And I shook his hand, it's all bloody and everything. No, I learned a lot. And, he taught me a few things about the cape thing. So, learning stuff like that was very interesting. Morocco was like another world. That was my first time in a Muslim country like that. I really fell in love with Marrakesh. And I had not planned to use Marrakesh in the novel. I only went to Marrakesh because I thought, if I'm in Morocco, I've got to see Marrakesh, But then I ended up using it in the next book, in Never Dream of Dying. So it was helpful to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Raymond. Well, as a matter of fact, that was the next book I wanted to discuss, Never Dream of Dying. I believe that one came out in 2001.
Uh-huh.
How did you ideate this book? What played into your construction of the plot?
Well, starting with High Time to Kill, the third book, I'd created this organization, kind of like Spectre. They were called the Union. And once I finished High Time to Kill, I kind of realized, ooh, it'd be cool to have a trilogy, a Union trilogy, where they're the bad guys over three books. So I kind of left it open at the end of High Time to Kill. And in Double Shot, they're the villains. And then Never Dream of Dying kind of winds it up. So I knew that in Never Dream of Dying, we're building toward the final confrontation between Bond and the leader of the Union. And by that time, he had moved his headquarters from Morocco to Corsica. So that was the impetus of why I set it in France and Corsica. And I also wanted to bring back Marc-Ange Draco, the character that was Bond's father-in-law briefly in Honor, Majesty, Secret Service. You know, Bond marries his daughter at the end of Honor, Majesty, Secret Service, and she dies.
Almost immediately.
I always wondered. Yeah. Yeah, and I always wondered, well, gee, what did Marc-Ange Draco think about that? Was he gonna, like, maybe blame Bond for that? You know, getting her killed? Mm-hmm. And also, Marc-Ange Draco was a bad guy to begin with. They befriended each other because of the daughter, but Marc-Ange Draco was the head of the Union Corps, which is like a mafia. He was the godfather of Corsica, you know? So he was already a bad guy. And it was just kind of convenient that Bond and Tracy fell in love, and so Draco was nice to Bond, and Bond was nice to Draco. Afterwards, who knows? So that's what I played with. That was the impetus for the plot. And, you know, the Fleming, Peter at the Fleming estate thought that was a great idea. And let's do that.
Very cool. Very cool. Thank you. The last book I wanted to discuss, Raymond, 2002, The Man with the Red Tattoo. So in this book, Bond travels to Japan. And I'd love to know, how did you immerse yourself in Japanese culture and incorporate it into the narrative?
Well, I was always interested in Japan. I loved You Only Live Twice, both the movie and the book. Mm-hmm. And I wanted Bond to go back because that novel, You Only Live Twice, was very, very important in Bond's psyche and the whole character arc that at least we have from Fleming. You know, Bond falls in love, sort of, with Cassie Suzuki, and he has a head injury that he has amnesia. And he lives with her for, what, a year or something like that. And she's pregnant with his child at the end of that book. And we never, never, never find out what happened to that child. John Pearson, in a book called James Bond, The Authorized Biography of 007, published in 1973, he speculates on the child who was a son. And I played with it in a short story called Blast from the Past that was published in Playboy magazine. So anyway, I thought bringing Bond back to Japan would be very good for the character and, you know, some ghostly-like imagery and things like that. And also, it kind of tied up some loose ends from the Union trilogy, because the guy who hired the Union in Never Dream of Dying was Japanese. So he was still around. So I wanted to finish him off. And so he becomes the main villain of the sixth book. So I knew, okay, we're going to do Japan for the sixth book. And I have a good friend here in Illinois who's very big into Japan. He's a white guy, but he loves Japan. He's been several times. He could speak the language well enough. He knows the country well. So I consulted him, and he made a lot of great suggestions about locations and things like that. And I finally said, well, look, I'm going to Japan. Why don't I, you know, bring you along? You want to go? You can be my guide. And that was very helpful because he could speak Japanese. And so the two of us toured all the locations of Japan that he helped recommend. So a lot of that book I owe to him. But it was my story. It was my plot, my characters.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Thank you, Raymond. I know, yeah, in terms of the plot and the theme, obviously bioterrorism is a central theme.
Oh, that's right. West Nile virus was kind of just becoming a thing then. And so I used that. But, you know, if West Nile virus in most cases wasn't deadly, I needed to make it deadly. So genetically engineered mosquitoes, of course. And I did go to a mosquito vector place in California to talk to them about that, if it was even possible. And yes, it was. So that's how that worked. Of course, that was all written before 9/11.
Yes.
That book was completely almost finished before 9/11 happened. If it had been after 9/11 and I had tried to go to a mosquito vector saying, how would we genetically engineer mosquitoes to carry a deadly West Nile virus?
Come with us.
You know, FBI call, please. So,
yeah. Thank you, Raymond. I really appreciate it. I'd love to ask you, I just have a few questions left, Raymond. I'm keeping an eye on our time here. I know you mentioned earlier when you sort of visualize James Bond in your head, you think of a sort of a noir. I was thinking about like the Maltese Falcon as you were talking, some figure like that. But I am curious if you do have a favorite James Bond actor and movie.
Well, there's Sean Connery and then there's everybody else.
Yeah.
I mean, for most people, I think of all ages, it's whoever they saw first on the big screen. You know, that's kind of who they really like the most. I saw Connery first, of course. I mean, but, you know, Connery was so good at it. And he invented the, you know, he created the character on the on-screen persona. If he had not been a success, we would not be talking about James Bond.
Yeah,
so that he was incredible in the part. And if you weren't around then in the 60s, he was huge. The movies were huge, and he was the number one box office star of 1966. He was everywhere. And people forget that today. And, you know, that's not to downplay the other actors. You know, they all had their strengths, and they all have their fans. So,
well, my generation is certainly the GoldenEye generation. You know, the video game came out, of course. So I have a special place in my heart for Pierce Brosnan, as probably won't surprise you. I think Daniel Craig's incredible. It's amazing to think there was ever a time when people thought he shouldn't be James Bond, that he was sort of, you know, didn't have the dark hair, didn't quite have the sparkly eyes and so on. But in any event, I'm fighting the urge to ask you, I will imagine you're familiar with the show Archer.
I know of it. I've never really watched it.
Okay, fair enough. The main character is sort of basically, what if we took the worst qualities of James Bond, the drinking, the womanizing, and so forth, and just, you know, cranked them all up to 11 and made that the central thrust of the character? I was just curious if you had a line on him, but perhaps I'll skip it. Let me see. I'd love to ask you, Raymond, if there's anything that you're working on currently you'd like to share with our listeners.
Well, I mean, we haven't touched on any of my non-Bond books. I've written a lot of non-Bond novels.
Yes.
You know, my Black Stiletto books, there's five of them. I call it a serial because it's really one big story broken up into five books, kind of like the Harry Potter books are. I feel that's my magnum opus. That's the best thing I've ever done. I love the Black Stiletto books. They came out between 2011 and 2014, and they've been optioned or in development, you know, in Hollywood, whatever that means. So that's, you know, it's about a woman in the late 1950s who goes to New York, puts on a mask and a costume, and becomes a vigilante for social justice. And she's active for about 5 years and then mysteriously disappears. In the present day, there's a grown man in the Chicago area taking care of his mother who has Alzheimer's. She's in a nursing home. And he discovers that she was the Black Stiletto. So the story goes back and forth in time, telling her story in the past and their story in the present. And it goes over five books. And yeah, so if you haven't read my Black Stiletto books, all you listeners, please check them out. And, you know, I'm very proud of some of my recent books. I had three books from Skyhorse recently in the last 6 years that kind of deal with social problems, but are thrillers. The Secrets on Chicory Lane, which is kind of deals with mental illness and child abuse in the story, but it's a thriller. And then In the Hush of the Night, which deals with human trafficking. It's an FBI procedural. And then Blues in the Dark, which deals with racism and sexism in Hollywood, but it's a murder mystery. Most recently, my book, The Mad, Mad Murders at Marigold Way, came out last fall. This is published by Beaufort Books. This is a dark comedy, murder mystery, that takes place during the first 2 months of the pandemic. So it's kind of like a Coen Brothers take on what a murder mystery would have been like in May of 2020, when everybody was paranoid and freaked out and there were no vaccines in sight and people were wearing masks and social distancing and stuff. There was still crime going on. There were still murders. So what do you do? You know, how do you deal with that? And so that's what I played with. And it's, you know, it's about stupid people doing stupid things.
A tale as old as time.
And it won the IPPI Award, the Independent Book Publishers Award for Mystery.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. That was my last book that was published. Lately, I've been doing some ghostwriting. I've been doing ghostwriting and what we call tie-in writing, all along. Like I did novelizations of the Splinter Cell video game, Metal Gear Solid, some of those games, Hitman, the video game, things like that. I mean, it's good bread and butter work. I've done some ghostwriting. I'm doing some ghostwriting right now because it's lucrative and it's, you know, pays bills and it keeps me writing until I come up with, you know, my next original Raymond Benson book.
Awesome. Fantastic, Raymond. Thank you. Ghostwriting. I'll have to get into that. Brilliant. So Raymond Benson, how can people find out about you, sir?
RaymondBenson.com is my website. I'm on Facebook. I've got two pages. I've got a personal page, which really gets all the action, and an author page. I'm sure if you type my name, you can find both. I am on X/Twitter. Not sure how much longer I will be on that. I'm on Instagram and Threads.
Excellent. Raymond Benson, thank you so much for taking the time for me today. I really appreciate it. I enjoyed speaking with you.
Well, thanks, Josh. I appreciate you having me on.
My pleasure. You take care, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.